Talk given Sunday, 12th March 1972.
Today, let us complete our considerations regarding what we call the elements: earth, air, fire, water. As you all know, all objects are made up of these elements. And let us bear in mind, I'm using the term in the old-fashioned way, instead of talking in terms of oxygen and nitrogen and phosphorus and calcium and all the rest of it, simply because it is more convenient, for one thing, to talk of the constituents of the world in terms of those elements, the old-fashioned terms for the elements, and also, which is more important, because of the fact that we are actually conscious in ordinary everyday life only in terms of solids, liquids, gases, temperatures, pressures, and so on. So it comes to the same thing: earth and solids, water and any substance which is liquid, together, etc., together also with their psychological counterparts. The psychological counterparts of earth, air, fire, water. Now, the whole world is made up of these elements. Not only India, but Greece and other countries have also talked in those terms. And we talked in those terms right up till recent times, until, in fact, the advent of modern experimental science and the re-establishment of the old speculative atomic theory with a new atomic theory, out of which grew all that knowledge which enabled us actually to deal with the atoms themselves and bend them to our will, which we couldn't in the days of pure speculation. And our modern knowledge, of course, quite dispossesses the old knowledge, and whilst the old speculations were interesting, they are, from the ordinary factual material point of view, wrong in most particulars. Nevertheless, we are actually conscious in terms of solids, liquids, gases, and so on. So it is convenient to continue to use the terms earth, air, fire, water. Now, all the world is made up of these elements. And not only the external world, but also the internal world. The world of our minds. The world of consciousness itself. And it would be worthwhile pausing a little bit to investigate that point. We look at something and we say, oh, there is a rock, or there is a lake. Are we seeing the rock itself? Are we actually directly conscious of the rock? Or is this what happens? Rays of light reflected from that rock enter our retina and create an electrical disturbance registered at the back of our brain, which makes us say, I see a rock. The there is no connection which has as yet been scientifically discovered between the electrical disturbances which register at the back of the brain and the psychical act of saying, I see a rock, or I see, if it's not a rock, I see a sunset or a lake or a man or a woman or whatever it may be. A better example, I see the sky. And we know that the sky is not there as a material object. But we can put our hands on our hearts and say, in absolute good faith, I see the sky, it is blue. Today, anyway. Now, what is it that actually happens? There is this gap between the so far discovered scientific fact of rays of light entering a retina, causing these electrical disturbances which have their own pattern and all the rest of it, but this psychical statement, I see so and so, is something which is different. So when I say that I see that rock or that lake, I am not seeing a rock or a lake in its own essential isness. I am conscious of my own mental percept. I am conscious of the picture in my mind, which I say is a rock. Or a sunset. A sunset is a very good example because here the next point is better illustrated. If all of us, if 10,000 people looked at the sunset, they would all give different descriptions of it. If all 10,000 of us are directly conscious of the sunset as sunset, and we described it, why should our descriptions be different? And you know that everybody gives a different description. What are we actually seeing? The sunset? Or the picture in the mind, this mysterious thing, the mind? We are conscious, really, of our own thought form, our mental photograph of what we experience in what we call the external world. You can see how the Hindu doctrine of Maya came into being. Buddhism also has the same teaching. That is why in Buddhism we have all is mind. The actual forms in which we are conscious of things, which makes us say, oh, this is a solid, this is a liquid, etc., etc., is due to the nature of our own mind and consciousness at work. Now, I say that an object is solid. That wall is a solid wall. If I walk towards it, I can't go through it. I'll probably get hurt if I walked fast enough. But supposing I were a neutrino. Let us grant that I'm a neutrino and also possessed of the ability to be conscious like a human being is conscious. What happens to me? Nothing stops my progress. I just move absolutely freely with the speed of light through space. What's more, I don't have any electrical charge. I have no mass. What an extraordinary phenomenon. Now, I as a neutrino, how would I see, touch, taste, hear? Of course I wouldn't. But how would I be conscious? We are granting consciousness to the neutrino. How would I be conscious of this world which is made up of what I as a human being, constituted like this, call earth, air, fire, water, and so forth? Now the importance of this lies here. We are so prone to say, this is the truth. Yes, this can be the truth, only within a very limited context, and only because such and such conditions prevail. It is, if you like, a conditioned reality. It is very real for us. For example, as I say, if I walk into the wall, I should be half or more than half insane to say that there is no wall there. My experience will tell me at once that there is a wall. So there is a conditioned reality for us. But we human beings are never awake to the fact that there is this conditioned reality. We take it as reality. And we think, feel, and we behave towards it, in relation to it, as reality. This is one of the basic reasons why we cannot be poised under all circumstances. We get upset, we get hurt, we get elated, we get depressed, and so forth. Now this weekend was a wonderful instance of it. How many faces did you see yesterday, for instance, on which the corners of the mouth were turned up and not down? And look at it today, corners of the mouth turned up. Why? Just the difference between what we call a horrible day and a lovely day. But let me use a horrible sounding word, but the horribility of yesterday and the loveliness of today is where? In my mind. Now, when we consider this matter together like this, intellectually we can see it. Perhaps we might not agree. We might argue, no, I don't agree with you, and so forth. Right. I won't argue with anybody. I'll say, whatever you say, all right, I'll be prepared to listen and hear the point of view and grant its validity, just as much as you, on your part, will grant the validity of what I have just said myself. But if we look deeply into it, and if we are concerned with the flowering out of intelligence and awareness of existence in its reality, if we are concerned with that, then we'll know that underlying and profounder than our two opposing relative viewpoints is a profounder truth. And that is that our mind pictures are just ephemeral forms which are sometimes attractive and sometimes unattractive, but in all cases they deceive our consciousness into accepting them as truth. Now, to see this intellectually with sufficient intensity is a very important step. If you see it with sufficient intensity, it helps us to remain poised and balanced, truly poised and balanced, not by repression, but truly poised and balanced under most circumstances in which we find ourselves. There will be some, however, which are so provocative, so hurtful, or so overpoweringly pleasant that we are bowled over, as we say. Now, if our concern is religion in the real sense, that means if our concern is transcendence itself, then our concern practically is the release of our consciousness from delusion. The freedom of our consciousness from being imposed upon and misleading us through illusory mental pictures. See, the psyche is not an ultimate. The modern world, and in the olden days too, philosophers too knew, some did anyway, they knew that all that we say with regard to matter, with regard to things, events, circumstances, situations, persons, and all the rest of it, are only our mental constructs. They are not the thing in itself. The thing in itself, we don't know. That they recognize. They recognize these are mental constructs. But most of the Western world has stopped short at that. In India, they penetrated more easily into the fact that the mental constructs are not finality. They are delusive and illusory too. And they recognize that they are more powerful and troublesome illusions than our childlike illusion that a stone is a stone and water is water as an absolute. You know how a child says it absolutely. This is a stone. That's the final fact about it, the final truth. There is nothing further to know or investigate. So you see, it's the same with the mind. Now look, you must try and really get hold of this. You see its tremendous significance and importance. We cling to ideas, to doctrines, to dogmas. As a result of that, we let our psyche get converted into a limited, restricted thing. But the essential nature of the mind is absolute freedom, absolute openness, absolute resilience. The body hasn't got that, and never will. That is why it is the body. But with the mind it is different. Instead of which, what happens to our minds? Our minds get imposed upon, distorted, and they are continuously misleading us. And where do they mislead us into? dukkha, sorrow, suffering, evil. And worst of all, this very mind makes us the bond slaves of those very forces which never allow us to know freedom, namely everything which has to do with pleasure and taking sides with pleasure against what is disagreeable to us. Now this is not to suggest that we must all be glum and miserable and throw aside pleasure. Not the least bit. That is, again, going to the other extreme. There is no middle way there in the true sense. That's a false way. The point is that we shall so understand and be so awake that as pleasure comes, we shall go through the experience and never hold it back. Let it pass. We shall learn out of it. And as pain comes, as sorrow comes, we shall go through the experience and let it pass away and never hold it back. But in actual fact, we store it all up in our memories, both the pleasure and the pain. And we trot it out every time the new experience, the new situation produces pain, suffering, or produces pleasure, and this ephemeral thing which we mistake for real happiness. You see? And with all that sort of actual living, we associate our so-called religious pursuit and our religious life. We are irreligious all the time, in fact. If we look sufficiently deeply into this, we will find that our impulse towards the religious life, good as it is, I'm not suggesting for a moment it is all bad, far from it. The greater part of it in all of us is certainly a good impulse, a right impulse. We do our best, and we are earnest, we are sincere about it. But this awful Mephistopheles who holds court at the back of our heads instead of the front, you see, he comes in and spoils everything all the time. Very subtly, he utilizes our religious drive as a subtle and super means for seeking pleasure, the realization of nirvana, for finishing with the series of lives, the reincarnations and all the rubbish that they talk about. Now this is very true. We practice according to a set discipline, the living of the good life. We don't kill somebody. We don't steal from our next door neighbor or somewhere else. We don't go running away with everybody else's wife or husband. We don't drink ourselves to death or indulge in cannabis. Why? Oh, well, of course, this is observing the moralities, you know. This is the first step, which is necessary for meditation. And finally, one day, there will come the final samadhi, and there will be the passing away into utter nirvana. Infinite reward for potty little finite actions. And the Lord God smiles and says, to hell with you, my darling. And that's all there is in it. You see, all this is the illusory cloud palace that the mind sets up, all sorts of pictures. But to see into the nature of the mind, that means not merely as an objective, external, philosophical pursuit, but as an actual perception of what is continuously happening in my psyche, continuously happening as a flow of a stream of thought and feeling, of emotion, of desire, of passion, of elation, of depression, and all the rest of it. Now, if I see it that way, I become aware, I become really conscious of the nature of the functioning of the mind. And it is that real awareness which transforms the psyche. That transformation of the psyche means the utter purification of the psyche. Remember Psyche in the grand old myth of Psyche and Eros is a mortal who only in finality, when the whole story is completed and she is united with Eros in eternity, her mortality is transformed into immortality, because no mortal can be in permanent union with the immortal. Quite impossible. This mortal is your psyche and my psyche, whether one be male or female. This is the mortal, that's this psyche. And this psyche is transformed through its complete and utter purification into the immortal creative power, which is pure mind, which is absolute mind. That is Eros. But we must see these things. We must really see them. If I'm gifted with the tongues of angels and were to tell you the absolute truth as God Almighty sees truth, it would be no use to you. It may please you, it may give you a sensation, it may give you an uplift, something sublime, something marvelous, an unforgettable experience and all that sort of thing. But it is of no use to you in reality. Why? Because whilst my words may produce all sorts of sensational effects, your mind will make its own pictures. Your mind is not capable of doing anything else, just as my mind is not capable of doing anything else than make the pictures which are expressive of the nature of my mind. Now you see, our basic illusion starts with the elements, our experience of the elements. And we don't know that we are interpreting reality in this way. Solids, liquids, gases, earth, air, fire, water, all the rest of it. Because we are constituted as we are. So we can't escape that. Because we are bodily constituted as we are, we will, of course, experience resistance with a physical object. We'll experience less resistance with a liquid object, still less with a gaseous, and, as we believe, none with what we call empty space, akasha or ether or whatever you like to call it. We know that. Because of our bodily constitution. See? If now, in addition, we awaken fully to the fact that these are experiences and observations which are true only within the limited context. And they are not absolute truth. Then, our whole set of values, our activities, our the way we express and direct our life energy will be entirely changed. And it will change itself. Now do remember that. It will change itself. If I am stupid enough to attempt to change it according to a preconception, then there will be nothing but failure. Why? Because all my assumptions or preconceptions are tainted by my present existing prejudices and biases. My limited powers of conceiving, my power of conceiving produces only distorted conceptions all the time. In the presence of the Absolute, in those moments of stillness and silence when the whole mind is utterly quiet, utterly pure, utterly empty, you will find that the mind has come, met its Sabbath. It has ceased to preconceive, to make thought forms, thought shapes. They don't belong to the realm of transcendence. They don't belong even to the realm of our mental life. They belong only to that realm which is concerned with our activity in the physical sphere as such, in the sphere in which we are conscious in terms of solids, liquids, gases. But the moment we take it into the sphere of the mind itself, and the moment we apply it in the sphere of human interrelationships, then woe betides us inevitably. This is something which we never wake up to. We go to our priests and our bhikkhus and our philosophers and our lecturers and our teachers and all the rest of it. And what happens? Haven't you noticed? A carrot is held in front of you. Draw you on. To what? To a desirable end. But I tell you that in the presence of the Absolute, in the presence of transcendence, all our desirables and undesirables are utterly non-existent. They have no meaning. They have no value. So will you wait till you get into the presence of transcendence? You can't wait. You will never get into the presence of transcendence whilst you have the desire to be there. Because the desire is self-oriented. Howsoever exalted, beautiful, wonderful, so-called unselfish a desire may be, your desire is always self-oriented. And by virtue of that fact, it is a binding thing. You and I are the makers of our own prison. We cannot say, we cannot act in terms of, I will break my prison. Not I will break my prison. I will be caught by authority, by higher powers, stronger powers, always and once more be brought back into prison. and those higher powers are in my own soul. Not that way. Never the way of violence. Never the way of trickery, of being one too clever. The eternal, the absolute, the divine, God, use what word you like, is always there forestalling me, the separate, limited, petty little me. Always, inevitably. Why? Because God and the Absolute are not outside you. They are bone of your bone and flesh of your flesh, utterly inside our very being. And we can't escape that. We can't seek that out. The Absolute, the Totality, the Transcendent, Pure Mind, the Adibuddha, use any word you like, can never be sought out. I can cease to obstruct. That is what the limited, the finite, the particular can do in relationship to the infinite, the unlimited, the absolute. I can cease to obstruct. And the beginning of that process is to recognize the elements as elements. They are what they are. And they are what they are to me because I am constituted thus, and my consciousness, therefore, under such restriction, inevitably functions restrictedly. When I really see that, then, quite naturally, without attempting to force myself, I will never grasp at earth. Money, possessions, property, all the rest of it. I will never grasp at water. All that you may classify under the heading water. I will never try to grasp at fire, light, ideas, knowledge, brilliant things, fame, authority, whatnot. No. Nothing of that. I will cease to grasp at it. When it comes to me, I will not shirk my responsibility. When the stream of life itself presents it here, then I will pay full attention to it, do my uttermost best, and let it flow past from moment to moment. Otherwise, if I grasp at it, in any shape or form, I have made inside my own psyche a little dark place, a dark power, which will one day, in my lifetime, here and now, demand repayment, demand resolution. This is the unworked out karma, the substrate for a reappearance of the conditioned state of mind here and now. Nothing to do with reincarnation or anything like that. You see? So I cease to obstruct. And the ceasing to obstruct takes place because consciousness is flowering out. Consciousness, the Atma, if you like to use really the best word for it, it is really orthodox conventional Buddhism's loss that it has dropped the word Atma. Atma is pure consciousness, pure awareness. The Buddha presents it in the series of jhanas and samapattis, and in the ultimate stage, the cessation, with the cessation of all feeling and perception. And he says, then you touch nirvana with your body itself. It is like that, he says. And that if you will take the trouble to study enough the deep teachings of the Upanishads, you will find the correspondence there. And in the Upanishads, they use the word Atma, that is all. And it was a better thing to do than stick to the word mind, either manas or chitta. You see? Better to do that than stick to the word mind, for the simple reason that the mind and all the mind shapes have been discovered to be illusory and not final, ultimate reality. The ultimate reality possible for man is that state of consciousness, of awareness, which the Hindus called Atma, one single word, which is very nice. The Buddha used the phrase Vijnanam Anidassanam Anantam Sabbato Bhavam. Vijnana, which is infinite, invisible, characterless, Anidassanam, all those meanings apply. Anantam, endless, not born, not dying. Sabbato, everywhere, Pabham, and in the Majjhima Pahang, accessible or shining. The two of them taught the identical thing. So now, to be non-obstructive, and one is non-obstructive by seeing what obstructs, that's all. Supposing there is a great road and barricades are set up. Now you can't positively produce road. All you do is remove the barricades. And there is the road. Free road. Open road. You can't sort of build an open road where there are barricades. There's nothing to build. There is only the act of removing that which obstructs. And what is it that removes that which obstructs? It is awakening. How do you awaken, you will ask? By paying attention. Mindfulness, this samasati, is the final key and the only key. It is this attentiveness which is the whole story. There is nothing else to do. The practice of a routine procedure only makes different mind shapes. I went to such and such a retreat, I went to such and such a vihara, I went to such and such an ashram. I myself have done all these things. So I know a little bit about them, you see. Oh, went through this, went through the other. Oh, it all felt very nice and wonderful. Oh, I can't tell you what a lovely experience it was. Don't try to tell me. I know, it is a lovely experience. And what does a lovely experience mean? Pleasant sensations. I got what I wanted. I progressed. But we never see that we have progressed from Holloway to Brixton or Pentonville. You see, the subtlety of the self, of selfness. So we invent doctrines. Oh, I'll go on like this, you know. Arrive at this stage, that stage. Now I'm almost nearing arhatship or moksha or whatever it is, you know, and all the rest of it. Only one more life to come back to this earth. And then, oh, nirvana. And what's nirvana? It's a wonderful place. When you get there, and can you buy a ticket for me there? Can you transport me there? Do you know where this there is? Is it north, south, east, west, heaven, hell, what? It's like that lovely story the Buddha used to tell sometimes to his disciples. He would say, but friend, you are talking like this. You say that you know a most beautiful and wonderful girl in the village with whom you are in love. Well now, is she tall? Is she short? Is she dark? Is she fair? Is she this, that, or that? Oh no, he doesn't know. Well then the Buddha suggests, do you think you might be under some illusion? It is like this. So now, we awaken by paying attention. And if we pay attention without expectation, without hope, without desire, but just attend, just as you actually just breathe air all through the day, it's a natural thing. The bloodstream just flows through the body naturally all through the day. If you just attend that way with all your energy, if you attend that way, the transformation process, the purifying process, the enlightening process takes place by itself. Life lives by itself, not because you or I do anything to make life live through us. We have no power to do that. See? So enlightenment takes place by itself. And afterwards, after the event, so to say, this enlightenment naturally finds its expression in your thought, your feeling, your speech, your actions, and most important of all, the activity of your senses through which you perceive. And the mind, the psyche behind those sense activities ceases to misinterpret, to misevaluate all that the senses convey to you. Now when that happens, you naturally don't grasp. When you naturally don't grasp, this is the healthy, happy state of renunciation. Isn't this something quite different from what we are usually led to believe? And we are merely led to believe, and that's all. But we are all muddle makers otherwise, in the ordinary way. Now you know, if for example there was a big audience here, 1,000 people, do you know one of the questions which will of course come up at once in the minds of perhaps 900 of them? But how will this help us to solve our present day problems? You know the real answer to that question? You or I will never solve our problems. You know what I mean by that? What I mean is this. I, as I am, attempting to solve my problem, or your problem, or the world problem, we all rush about trying to solve the world problem, will only produce one, and in all likelihood 10 or 100 new problems in my flounderings. That is what I do. And the longer I live, and the more energy I spend in solving these problems, the worse the situation becomes. You know the good old English statement, no fool like an old fool. He's the worst fool of the lot. I have gone on being a fool. So I'm the grand fool now, as compared with the youngsters. This is what happens. What is the fundamental reason for that? I want to solve a problem. No I, the limited, isolative, self-conscious person, who out of his foolish mind produces this abstraction which has no reality called the I. And it is to this mythical point that our activities are oriented. How can we produce that resolution, that true resolving, which is harmony? We are desire-driven. We don't know the meaning of desire. Stop going to lectures and this, that, and the other. Don't come here. But do come here, because love brings you here. Not love for me, because that's as absurd and stupid as being in love with the bottle that you drink, or something like that. Not that, but just love. The love that you don't know and won't know. The brain, the mind, will never know that which is transcendent. Because wisdom moves your feet towards those pastures which spell the fruition of life and of human beings. Come because of that. But anything that is self-oriented will inevitably fail, and it will go into the maw of death, devoid of fruition and fulfillment. The maw of death eats up the ripe as well as the unripe. So whether you or I am the ripened fruit or the unripened fruit, the maw of death takes in everything in any case. But if you are the ripened fruit, the maw of death takes that ripe fruit in, and it is transformed into a light which adds in some mysterious way to the light of transcendence itself. And thereby transcendence has found fruition and fulfillment through you, the finite particular being. And it is this fruition of transcendence through you, the limited one, which is the real meaning of nirvana. So you see, of the elements we are made. Our cells, the body, and the whole psychophysical organism is made of the elements. Of these same elements is the world made, the world of phenomena, the world of psychical manifestations and influences, the world of what we commonly call the mind. Everything that is made of the elements in some form or degree. As we free ourselves from all the illusions which arise in our minds through our interaction with the elements, and as we continue to pay our entire attention with all our energy to the immediate now, there will come enlightenment. There will come intelligent perception, true perception, not misperception. And you will find that all greed and hate and delusion and so forth will fall away altogether. From you, the purified focus point of the transcendent reality. And that is your liberation.